downstairs at night. They didn't even know where I was. Social reproduction, injury, and professional hockey. So in this presentation, what I intend to do is draw from a larger study into professional hockey and injury in order to explore some of the costs of athletic labor. I contend that the full extent of the exploitation suffered by the athletic laborer can only be accounted through an examination of how this type of labor functions as a form of social reproduction for spectators of sport. Injury is essential to this process, for it is only through the sacrifice, or at least potential sacrifice, of the athlete's body that professional sport can be invested by fans with the level of meaning required to provide them the subjective renewal they seek from sport and upon which the political economy of these games is predicated. In performing social reproductive athletic labor, the professional hockey player must thus make a tremendous physical and subjective sacrifice, one that often has lifelong, even life-threatening, implications. I will draw upon a set of semi-structured anonymous interviews with retired professional hockey players to exemplify both the ubiquity of injury in high-performance sport and its very deleterious consequences. I'm going to try to emphasize the interviews over the theory. I'm going to go through the theory kind of quickly at first, then spend a lot of time with the interview results. I think that's more interesting for you today. So let's begin quickly with Marx. In Capital, he demonstrates that the capitalist economy exists to systematically produce surplus value, or profit, through the exploitation of the worker's labor power. For this productive circuit of the economy to continually reproduce itself, labor power must itself be perpetually reproduced. The most basic form this reproduction must take is the worker's continued subsistence. However, social reproduction also involves the reproduction of the laboring class in the form of the nurture and socialization of children as prospective laborers. Although only the wage laborer is explicitly mentioned in Marx's discussion of productive capital, others must do the social reproductive work necessary to sustain and reproduce the current and future labor power the system demands. Historically, this work has primarily fallen to women. Joanna Brenner and Barbara Laslett explain how this concept has been taken up in the Marxist feminist tradition. They write, "Social reproduction can thus be seen to include various kinds of work, mental, manual, and emotional, aimed at providing the historically and socially, as well as biologically, defined care necessary to maintain existing life and reproduce the next generation." Bridget Anderson, in her work on domestic labor as social reproduction, and Anna Agathangelou, in her study of sex and domestic workers, take this notion of psychological and emotional reproduction further, suggesting that when there is an affective dimension to social reproduction, when the worker's labor functions to reproduce some element of the client's subjectivity, something fundamental is taken from the worker in the process. The sacrifice of selfhood is the additional level of exploitation, I argue, present in social reproductive work. I argue that high-performance sport is not merely a productive sector of the economy that generates surplus value, it's also a site of social reproduction that reproduces labor power by satisfying the affective needs of fans who otherwise risk suffering from burnout due to the alienation, isolation, and intense mediation of advanced capitalist life. My position is that sport temporarily satisfies the affective needs created by the system by providing a sense of meaning and community. Fans watch sporting events and feel a part of something that is larger than themselves. They feel like they are part of the team and part of the community of others who are also part of the team. Although athletes obviously labor with their bodies, in a manual sense, this manual labor has an emotional consequence for fans. By providing a fetishistic sense of meaning and belonging, it enables the spectator to feel temporarily whole. For athletes, however, inevitably, in the process of this labor, bodies become seriously injured. These injuries accumulate to the point at which they can become debilitating, particularly once athletic careers end. This damage to the body is not merely physical. It can lead to a crisis of identity, as most athletes understand themselves as people with extraordinary physical capacities. Yet these injuries are not an incidental part of athletic labor. I argue the fans are only able to fully vicariously invest in athletes because they are willing to sacrifice their bodies for the team. This is what makes the athletic community meaningful and real for the fan. Yet the injured, retired, or simply underperforming body of the athlete is readily discarded by the spectator in favor of a new, more promising vessel. This helps explain the subjective crisis of the ex-athlete, for she, but in this context mostly he, goes from being the locus of excessive emotional investment, affect, and meaning to the bearer of none whatsoever. It is this sacrifice that is the athlete's true surplus labor. He gives his entire self to reproduce the fan, yet he is compensated only for his productive labor. For the few truly fortunate elite athletes, Pacquiao's, Mayweather's, this compensation is plentiful. For most high-performance athletes, it is not. Just a brief note now on methodology. These excerpts of testimony I'm about to show you come from a larger project in which I conducted semi-structured interviews with 8 former professional hockey players and 8 spectators of sport. The study was never intended to provide a definitive picture of social reproduction in sport, but rather it's simply a qualitative examination of how some former professional hockey players experienced their time in this occupation. All interviews are anonymous, and the names and identifying characteristics of players, including the teams they played on, have been changed to ensure that they cannot be identified. I believe that this anonymity contributed to a spirit of uncommon candor amongst players accustomed to and defensive about media interviews. Players were recruited through a snowball sampling approach and participated in a range of levels of professional hockey, from the United Kingdom to the North American minor leagues to the NHL itself. So for most of the rest of this presentation, I'd like to provide a window into the consequences of social reproductive labor in order to demonstrate the full cost of this work for those who must bear it. Before delving into the implications and consequences of injuries, however, I think it's worth briefly reflecting on the role of injury as an idea upon the experience of players. For injuries have an effect even before they occur. Haunting athletes is an anxiety-provoking specter of what might happen to them. The end of their careers, perhaps the loss of their physical agency, anytime they set their skates upon the ice. Lawrence F., who had a lengthy career as an enforcer in the NHL and AHL, remarks upon the way he conceptualized this threat during his playing career. NKL, so during your playing career, how much did you think about the possibility of being injured? How much was it on your mind in a general sense? Lawrence F., well, in my case, all the time, because I was a fighter. So every guy that I fought, whether he was a lefty, a righty, I was always worried if I get hit the wrong way and get knocked out, get my jaw broken, you know, my eye socket broken, I'm going to be injured for a long time. That means they bring another guy up to do my job. If he does good, I don't have a job anymore. So for me, every game. Later, he demonstrates that the toll of providing spectators with meaning through a willingness to engage in physical violence was a constant fear of injury and failure that completely undermined his ability to take satisfaction from his work. He explains, But now you say you're in a different period. You say it's more peaceful. Do you actually feel more satisfaction from the current period than when you were playing? Lawrence F. My NHL career was a blur. The road to get the NHL was memorable. I call it the journey. Once I got there, it was, believe me, it was a nightmare. Because it was a nightmare to stay there. It was a nightmare to fight. It was a nightmare, everything. Like, it wasn't fun. In the summertime, I'd be at my cottage, and August would come, and I'd say, I'm about a month out from bare-knuckle fighting. How much fun is that? So here I am, supposed to be enjoying the off-season, and I'm sitting there going, you know, I was on pins and needles, not even sleeping. First exhibition game was against Philadelphia. Already I knew I got 3 fights in that game. If I don't do well, I'm not making the team. How much fun is that? You live it every minute. Lawrence F.'s testimony here powerfully refutes the hegemonic narrative that playing professional sport is a dream everyone should aspire to and feel grateful to achieve. Instead, he recasts experience as a form of prolonged emotional abuse, which he was forced to constantly anticipate the nightmare of having to subject himself and others to physical violence in front of thousands of onlookers. Similarly, Darren Kay, who also had a lengthy career as an enforcer in the NHL and AHL, echoes the nightmare experience of Lawrence F. NKL, was the possibility of being hurt, the potential of being hurt, something that entered your mind while you were playing? Darren Kay, oh, every game, every fight. NKL, oh, really? Can you try to walk me through a little bit how that would work? Darren K., well, I think you just got to put yourself in our shoes. I mean, if you were to walk outside tonight in front of 20,000 people and square off with a big guy, I'm sure you'd have a fear about getting injured. NKL, sure, yes. Darren K., you know, but it's not different for us. NKL, no, of course. And was that fear a question of humiliation from the fans? Was it about losing your livelihood? Darren K., humiliation, getting hurt, losing your job, letting your teammates down. This is a telling extended passage, one I did not probe too hard because I had the sense that Darren Kay was not altogether comfortable elaborating on the subject. The gist of the point is evident, however. First, part of the psychological toll of his job was the constant anxiety he experienced about the possibility of being seriously hurt, something we saw also, of course, in the testimony of Lawrence F. Second, he also lived with the constant fear of being humiliated in front of 20,000 people. He was acutely aware that the nature of his work was spectacular and was similarly conscious of the implications of that, the fact that he would be reviled and discarded for failing to fulfill his role. Sean O, who played professionally in the United Kingdom and the Southern United States, was also constantly vigilant about the possibility of getting hurt while playing. He says, anything with my head. I was kind of, you know, I remember going to the bench lots of times too, and just, you know, when I would take a hit, and they'd say, hey, you okay? Just check the eyes. Just, they used to always say, just check the eyes. How's the head? That's all I ever cared about, right? Because I wasn't playing at a level where millions and millions of dollars were at stake too, right? You're playing at a thing where you're almost, I don't want to say paycheck to paycheck, but pretty much, you know, you were. If you took that away, the whole mystique of playing, like playing pro or minor pro, which you always wanted to do, that could be taken away from you pretty quick if you're showing that kind of stuff. Here he reveals that the possibility of head injury was a constant source of anxiety throughout his career because of the threat it posed to his livelihood. For the player at the minor or semi-pro level, the implications of injury are even more disquieting, for there is less infrastructure and patience allotted to recovery. To be hurt is, in a very real sense, to lose one's job. Nearly every player I spoke with suffered some form of injury over the course of his professional hockey career, in most cases at least one of a very severe nature. With respect to head injuries, it's useful to provide some initial context for the ensuing comments. Although all concussions are dangerous, the greatest risk comes from repetitive injury, which has been linked in hockey players and athletes in other contact sports to chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. The symptoms of which include depression, emotional instability, suicidal ideation and behavior, a short fuse, and substance abuse. As the disease worsens, the effects are especially felt in terms of memory impairment, ability to plan and organize, language difficulties, aggression, and apathy. It's worth keeping this in perspective as we advance to a discussion of the injuries suffered by the hockey players I interviewed, for what becomes clear from their testimony is that concussions are a ubiquitous part of the world of professional hockey. Luke C., a high-profile player in the NHL for over a decade, expanded at length on his experiences with injury over his career. What he reveals is the incredible amount of pain he was forced to endure in order to fulfill his role as a social reproductive athletic laborer. NKL. Could you just be a bit more specific for me now about the nature of those injuries, especially the biggest ones? Luke C. All kinds of injuries. Like when I was in Anaheim, like 1 year, I got my jaw broken. I got hit a few more times during the year and ended up breaking my jaw, or re-breaking it, twice, you know? NKL. Oh, wow. Luke C. So anyway, when you play with a broken jaw and your helmet has this big thing around your face to kind of protect you, well, obviously everybody knows that you're playing hurt. You know, people were not worrying about the hits to the head, concussions, and stuff like that. So obviously, if you have your jaw broken 3 times in the same year, it's because you got hit to the head 3 times. Believe it or not, those 3 times that I got my jaw broken, the only thing that happened was 1 2-minute penalty. He laughs. NKL. Wow. Luke C. I mean, so yeah, it's many, many different kinds of injuries. Just the slashing to the hands, like, you know, there's 9 of my 10 fingers that have been broken. NKL. Wow. Luke C. I've never missed a game because of broken fingers. So again, it's just an example of what players go through. Just broken ribs sometimes, you know? You play with broken ribs where you have a tough time breathing and stuff like that. So yeah, there's all kinds of things that you go through, you battle through, that people don't really know about. Luke C. indexes the way in which pain and injury become institutionalized as part of the game. The tacit sanction of violent tactics and behavior are logically consistent with the fact that professional hockey must have high stakes in order to entice fans to invest meaning and then finances into the game. For players like Luke C., this means they must constantly endure pain and harm to their bodies in the course of their labor, working conditions that would scarcely be tolerated in any other profession. Now, Lawrence F. was among the most candid of the interview subjects in this study on the subject of his experiences with injury. In the following testimony, he articulates the full extent of the physical and emotional harm he endured as a result of his athletic career and the long-term consequences on his quality of life. NKL, do you feel any differently about the decision to play through those injuries now that your career has ended? Lawrence F., the only one is probably my concussions. NKL, okay, and why is that? Lawrence F., well, because there's nights I didn't even know where I was. I got in a fight on a Friday night. I got hit so hard that I was concussed, and I didn't remember anything until Tuesday. I ended up having 2 more fights that week, and then actually scored 2 goals. And it all came to me Tuesday where I'm going, what? And I realized there was a problem. So when it has to do with the brain, then you're going, okay. I didn't realize it back then because I just played through it, right? NKL, yeah. How many concussions would you say you probably had during your career? Lawrence F., documented 8. and kale. And that's documented at a time when they weren't documenting nearly as many. Lauren says, yeah, so who knows? With all the fights I had and the hits and stuff, I couldn't tell you. As he continues, it becomes clear that these consequences only worsened in severity after he retired from his career. And Kale, and what about the concussions? Do you feel like you noticed that? Lawrence F., well, that's what bothers me, because there's little things, and this is the best example I can use. I forget if I brush my teeth or not, so I'm licking my teeth, and I'll go back to see if my toothbrush is wet. So there's little things that are happening where you're going, are the long-term effects sinking in from the headshots, right? So that does kind of scare me a little bit. That does make me think, because my memory's not as good. I used to have a great, I could remember anything, and now I'll have people come up to me that I should know. I had a guy come up to me at a game last night, honestly, but all day long I know him. I don't even know who it is. He goes, Lawrence, it's Todd from roller hockey. I go, no kidding, how you doing? And that's when I kind of got a bell going on. There's no way I should have forgotten who that was. So those are the little things that you're going, okay, normally that wouldn't happen. His experience of the world has been irreversibly altered by the damage he suffered as an athlete. Reading slightly between the lines, he suggests here perhaps that he's not even the same person he once was. Great memory was part of his identity previously, yet now he is left fumbling to recall basic acquaintances, and still more disturbingly, even to recall if he has brushed his teeth only moments earlier. This is the ultimate cost of social reproduction. However, it is not the only consequence Lawrence F. experienced as a result of his career in professional hockey. And Kale. So, just to sort of follow up on the same sort of theme, do you have any teammates you can think of specifically who have been significantly affected by injury that you can recall, whose experiences stand out to you? Lawrence F. Well, you look at some of the guys who committed suicide. You know, one of my former teammates, Daryl S. He ended up hanging himself, being drunk, and it was a lot to do with his health. It has a lot to do with some personal issues. But I look at him and say, why would he have taken his life? With a beautiful family, he had money, and I do stem it to, like the football players, to brain trauma and not feeling well. There's a profound conviction here, perhaps born of experience, that head injury is life-altering. This is what he sees when he looks at athletes across different sports, and it's what he sees when he looks at former teammates. The toll of physical play is the inability to appreciate a beautiful family or money. It's the inability to lead a complete life. It is, in the most extreme cases, the inability to continue living at all. This ultimate, most extreme sacrifice, the sacrifice of the sense that it is possible to endure life itself in the aftermath of a professional career, is something Lawrence F. is able to relate to firsthand. And Kale, do guys talk about these sort of experiences? Lawrence, no, you never talk about it. You know, I contemplated suicide before, but I was on drugs and alcohol, and I was, you know, in the worst part of my life until I cleaned it up. But I do know that going on with depression and probably the head trauma and all that, I was close to taking my own life, right? I just didn't know how to do it. So, this is the most startling revelation of all. Even for a player like Lawrence F., who was able to move on with his life, suicidal thoughts and drug and alcohol use were direct consequences of his experiences with professional hockey. We see further reference to this sort of phenomenon in a brief passage from the testimony of Chris M., a former OHL player. He says, well, my own experience, I separated my shoulder and had a minor concussion. And then when I realized I wasn't really up in the NHL draft, I figured, you know, I was smart enough to get out. A lot of people pushed and pushed and pushed and found themselves with nothing but addictions at the end. For some, the long-term consequences of athletic labor are more physical than psychological. Vassil D., a former AHL goalie, speaks to the way that physical damage accrued initially during his hockey career has taken an increasingly significant toll on his health with the passage of time. And Kale, yeah, and do you feel any different now that your career is over? Do you feel like you might regret some choices you've made in terms of playing through injury? Vassil D., yeah, I hurt my shoulder in my fourth year of professional hockey. I kept playing through it, and you know, I actually injured it more. I had surgery on it. But now, being 36 years old compared to when I was 24, I'm having a lot more pain through it now than when I played, right? So when you're 24 years old and you're young, injuries don't mean anything to you. You just want to play hockey, right? Now that I'm 36, I realize, wow, maybe I should have took some time, some more time off, because of my future and, you know, doing stuff around the house or with my kids. I've got 4 kids now. You're lifting them. There, you can feel the pain still, right? So evidently, the injuries suffered during his career have had an increasing impact on his quality of life as he ages. A reality he and no doubt others did not fully anticipate during their playing days. Although it's evident throughout his interview that Darren Kay is not entirely comfortable expanding on the topic of head injury, the following comments suggest that these injuries have played a major role in his life. NKL. Now, do any of the injuries you suffered, and obviously there's a whole range, right? There's the orbital bone, the fibula, the thumb, but then also the concussions. Do any of the injuries you suffered currently impact your life? Darren Kay. Well, my ankle, very, very stiff, not a lot of movement, not a lot of mobility in it. And then obviously, he pauses. The concussions, I think, have had a part to play too. NKL. Yeah? Darren Kay. NKL. How do you experience the consequences of the concussions? Darren Kay. You know, the difficult stuff. Memory loss, tension headaches, that kind of stuff. I mean, it's... He pauses. I don't know how to put a finger on it, but... Here again, he reveals a great deal, without saying very much, about the long-term consequences of the injuries he suffered. The ankle injury and concussions are obviously things he will have to deal with for the rest of his life. Again, his seeming reticence to elaborate is perhaps the most evocative element of his testimony. It's evident he's still struggling to reconcile the consequences of the sacrifices he had to make as a professional player. The emotional strain of this struggle is rendered more explicit as the interview continues. NKL. More generally, do you find that you ever talk much to other former players about their experiences with injury, concussions? Darren Kay. No. NKL. No? Okay. Is it the opposite? Is it something people do not speak about? Darren Kay. Well, I mean, I don't like to rehash any head problems that I had, or, you know, any injuries. I'm trying to move on with my life, right? When you're in the middle of playing hockey, you're so consumed with injuries and your health, and now I'm just happy to, you know, not have to fight anymore. Be a good father. Curtis Yu, who played 2.5 years in the NHL and OHL, AHL, is more candid about the effects of injury upon his life. NKL. So I mean, at this point in your life now, do those injuries, especially the knee injury, but just in general, maybe the concussions, any of those injuries, do they currently affect your quality of life today? Curtis Yu. Yeah, all of them. NKL. All of them? Really? Curtis Yu. Yep. NKL. Can you just give me a sense of how that is? Curtis Yu. Well, I've been told I'll need a knee replacement because the last surgery or last checkup I had, my knee is very arthritic because of the rubbing, you know, bone on bone. The shoulders will pop out every once in a while, and I have to do some exercises to get them back in. My back aches regularly. The first thing I do in the morning is I take pain medication, and I'll, you know, follow it up with probably pain medication later on in the day, depending on how I'm feeling. But everything hurts, he laughs. So, you know, when the weather changes, I'm like the old man on the rocking chair. I can tell when the weather's going to turn bad just because of the way my joints are feeling. So it does affect how I can't run, so I'm limited physically in what I can do. There's no quick sports like basketball or tennis or any of those kind of things. You know, biking is fine, swimming is fine. I still skate occasionally, but, you know, I can't perform, obviously, like I was, or like a younger man would. But to me, the biggest issue I deal with is pain. NKL. Yeah, okay. And what about the concussions? You don't feel so much in the way of long-term effects? Curtis Yu. No, I think it's affected my memory. I need to write everything down. Otherwise, I'll forget most tasks, and if somebody tells me something or they don't want me to do something, I tell them either send me an email or I have to write it down. Otherwise, I'll forget certain things. You know, I'm very good with numbers. I can remember numbers. I can remember phone numbers and locker combinations and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, details or, you know, conversations that I have with people or names and so on, I think it has affected my memory on those things. There's not much annotation required here. The impact on his life of his brief experience in professional hockey spans the broad range of consequences most former athletes experience, from chronic pain to loss of mobility to loss of memory and beyond. What I hope has become clear over the course of this presentation is the tremendous cost of athletic social reproductive labor. Because athletes must be willing to subject their bodies to enormous harm in order to validate the meaning produced by professional sport, they experience manifold consequences that shape their post-career lives. But I believe the testimony of this study reveals that there is a cost to athletic labor that is not typically named or acknowledged. This cost is not incidental, but rather at the very heart of the dynamic that makes professional sport a viable political economy. It is only in the sacrifice of the athlete's body that the fan can fully come to extract the meaning from professional sport that she so desperately needs and desires within the context of neoliberal capitalism. Thank you.
Thanks. So we've got two more presentations to go, but we thought at this point we could maybe pause for a minute and see if there's any questions that people might have for Nathan or for Janelle or for Gamal before we go on to hear from Simon and Anne here. But also, if people want to grab some food, take this opportunity to do that as well.
Yes, I'll give it a go. This is a comment for the last speaker. You mentioned that hockey players sacrifice their bodies for the team. Maybe not so much. This is applicable to the 1970s, to the Canada versus the United USSR, something in this era, when the hockey players from the USSR were adamant in sacrificing their bodies for the ideology, for the system, for the state, for the Soviet Union. Not so much in your context when the players, as other speakers mentioned, earn stunning amounts of money in their life careers in sport. So I think this comment is out of your context of study. Maybe your conclusion and your introduction, when you talked about political economy of sports, are not supported by your body, your study. Your study were mostly about the injuries, how the athletes spoke about their struggles, their life after they finished their career, and your interpretation of their accounts.
Can you tell me what was contradictory about it?
Yes, from my point of view, your interpretation was about their health problems. Their health problems, the problems that they had after their career. It is micro level. It's not macro level of political economy. And there, it was mostly. It was a micro-level analysis, and your conclusion was about macro, and your introduction about Marx was about macro-level. This is what I think.
Okay. Before responding, Nathan, maybe we'll see if there's other questions for the other panelists. And we'll, overall, I guess we'll allow maybe 10 minutes or so for this before we'll go back to the presentation. So one here and Stephanie. And I may add myself, but we'll see if there's others. Okay.
All right. I mean, this is kind of for all three of you because you've all sort of touched on various aspects of sport and how it's alienating or fetishized community and the bad, celebrating very, not necessarily the best ideals. Is there any good in sport? Like, I'm starting to see where you're coming from with the wanting to turn off basketball, but is there anything that we can celebrate in sport?
Okay, I'll just preface this by saying I'm completely ignorant about sport and I'm not a sports fan, but I thought there was an interesting there was two interesting things for me in particular. One is about the way in which you both Gamal and Nathan are talking about sport as a form of social reproduction, and I'd like to hear us talk about that a little bit more. And The other is about maybe, which is a connection between what Janelle had to say about the fight and what's expected in the fight, and what Nathan had to say about the kind of hockey that's required for to draw and attract audiences. And I wonder, so on the social reproduction element, I mean, I think that that's really quite interesting in that, you know, the way that feminist political economists in particular have conceptualized social reproduction has had to do with, very directly with the reproduction of the laboring body and mind, and what it takes to make sure that workers are available to work on a day-to-day basis, right? And obviously it's not the only part of social reproduction. And I'm just wondering, you know, to what extent is a sport really a form of social reproduction that fits within that framework? Like, maybe we could talk a little bit more about that, because I'm not sure I completely buy that. But anyway, I would be interested to hear you talk a little bit more about why you've conceptualized sport as part of the process of social reproduction. And does that mean that all popular culture should be understood as part of social reproduction? I don't think that's typically how we understand that, but maybe we should. But I would like to hear a bit more about that. The other aspect of my question was about maybe thinking a little bit more about the audience. So Janelle said that there was a lot of discontent amongst the people that you were watching the fight with about the nature of the fight and certain expectations about what that fight should involve as a kind of experience, and that I'm putting words in their mouth, but they in some ways complained about the lack of skill, perhaps, that was expected to be displayed in that fight. And that really it was kind of a mock fight. It was really kind of going through the motions and not really engaging in what a population of boxing aficionados might expect from a fight. And I think that raises a question about hockey for me, and whether or not there's something historically specific about the kind of hockey that needs to be played today to draw an audience. Because if I think about, like, my dad's generation and the kind of hockey that they like, it's not the kind of hockey that you're talking about. Actually, that the kind of hockey that involves excessive amounts of violence, I think from a previous generation of hockey aficionados, that is seen as a kind of de-skilled hockey, much like the kind of boxing you're talking about today is actually de-skilled boxing. And so I'm wondering if we're actually making some claims about the kind of sport, the way that sport works in capitalism, that's actually a little bit dehistoricized, and maybe we could be a little more, I wonder if we could be more specific about what's happened to change the nature of the sport spectacle, that it requires, if we agree with that, it requires a certain kind of violence, or, you know, whether or not there's something interesting about the de-skilling of sport that's going on here. Now, again, I'll end by saying I don't know anything about sports, and that was all made up on the fly. So if it's not coherent, that's why.
All right. One last question to Amanda, and then we'll go back to the panelists.
Well, I kind of want to hear the answer to Stephanie's questions. So
it's
kinda
so far as
we
have
to roll. So someone who looks like is there good in sport too, but and someone who does watch sport but not very well. Yeah, I also am intrigued by the social reproduction argument, and I'm not wholly, I don't know, but one of the things that made me think of, and I think this applies across the different panels too, obviously you're all talking about high performance male sports, right, so high levels of masculinity, very particular kinds of masculinity as well involved in these, but you also all talked about sports as at the level of consumption, right, and as you're saying, you know, that complicates it. And as production, and as very managed, high-managed production that uses up bodies in particular ways. But I also, in addition to studies, that I'm interested in the question also of sport as labor itself, and so, and especially in this idea of the injuries, what I was hearing in the evidence was, I think, for me, that was less evidence of, or less connected to the notion of social reproduction as it is to production. Right, that these are workers, very high paid, well compensated celebrity workers who, you know, from whom still surplus, you know, there is surplus extraction. And, you know, much like, you know, miners or construction workers whose bodies also are disposable, right, very disposable, who suffer enormous amounts of injury, lifelong injury, very difficult to get that recognized. Like, in what way does this high performance, this hyper masculinized, celebritized, if that's a word, consumption dimensions of these sports change the nature of this as labor that makes hockey players, for example, not analogous, or boxers, not analogous to minors and the desperate injuries that they receive, right, or lifelong injuries. And can I have one more thing? Just a thought that this may go. This nobody has answers. But the other thing I was thinking about as well is also consent, right? That in sport there's a particular legal framework that allows consent to injury, that makes boxing possible, for example, that makes hockey fights possible, that makes them not punishable as assault, right? Because it's otherwise assault. That's not evident, for example, and there's considerable work being done on this now for perhaps obvious reasons, for example, in BDSM practices, where in fact the law does not allow you to consent to some practices, even if you do, right? So we allow, especially men, to consent to being assaulted, right, as workers for the purposes of consumption, right? And so, and just thinking about it, that's not a question, but just thinking about it also is running across your papers.
Before you answer, may I just put in an anecdote, a way of putting it? I, unfortunately, watch boxing. And for a while, there was a trick to make the audience, the television audience, more interested, and they put microphones in the corners so that you could hear the referee and the trainer talk to the fighter in between rounds. And I was watching one fight where Chuck was getting badly beaten up, and he was sitting hapless in his corner. And the referee came up to him and said to him, "Are you all right, son?" And he just grunted, and he said to him, "Okay, what's 2 and 3? And the man looked up and said, "If I knew that, do you think I would be doing this?" And that goes to the labor issue. These people are workers in the most obvious way.
Okay.
Just a quick question for Janelle. Mm. To what extent do you read the way Mayweather fights now as really about the assertion of control over his own labor and limiting, I wouldn't say exertion, but a very defensive way of fighting, being like, this game has been rigged for so long, mm-hmm. with overwhelmingly white promoters, white production companies, and now I'm asserting control over my labor, and I'm going to fight the way I want to fight to minimize injury and to exert mm-hmm. as minimum amount of labor as possible in order to maximize the profits that now accrue to me, as opposed to who they used to accrue to.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
Okay, Well, let's go
where
give,
to start?
Give each panelist a chance to respond. I guess I'll ask if people could be a little brief. Notwithstanding these questions, I mean, we've got an entire panel, I think, that would come out of these questions. But we do have two more presentations to get to, and we'll have some more time afterwards.
I'm willing to sacrifice my...
No.
You're
going
to have to respond to that.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll start with Nathan, and then Emma.
Okay, well... There were a number of questions, and I'll try to sort of weave things together. And if I leave things out, I'm not actually trying to admit. So maybe even if we have time at the end, as Mark said, we can come back to that, because I know we don't have too much time right now. What I'm realizing in hearing your responses is that maybe there was, in a certain sense, a bit of a... I made a bit of some errors in terms of how I selected this talk from the larger work that I drew upon, because, of course, this is like a book-length attempt to explain this concept, which I tried to distill to 25 minutes, and I selected it largely based on what I felt was going to be some of the more interesting, sort of salient moments in terms of the testimony of the athletes, and I really minimized the amount of time I spent dealing with the theory and the theoretical connections.